Iran's leader tells the visiting Turkish president that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria, and the entire region, and they will benefit terrorists. Iran and Turkey vow to expand bilateral trade and military ties. The two countries have signed several cooperation agreements in Tehran. The UN Special Committee slams what it calls the protracted occupation of Palestinian land by Israel and the regime's entrenched culture of impunity. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, starting with comments by a leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, saying that any military action against northern Syria would definitely harm Turkey, Syria, and the entire region. The leader says that fighting terrorism is a must, but military incursion in Syria will benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei also underlined the significance of Syria's territorial integrity. The leader said that problems in Syria should be resolved through negotiations. The leader made those comments in a meeting with the visiting Turkish president. Recep Tayyip Erdogan also said that terrorist groups in Syria are supported by Western countries, including the U.S., that are providing them with heavy weaponry. The issue of Palestine was also raised during a meeting. Ayatollah Khamenei said that Israel is the main force driving a wedge among Muslim countries. He added that the U.S. and Israel cannot stop Palestinians' deep-rooted movement. Masoud Chajiri, head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says that issues in West Asia need to be resolved by regional states, not by any foreign power.
What is very clear is that as Ayatollah Khamenei clearly identified, the issues of the region needs to be resolved by the powers in the region, and the interference from the United States and Israel has always created negativity, chaos, death, and destruction. And I think if that concept is understood by everyone, then issues that there are and there always will be could be resolved by the regional powers and regional governments. And the fact of the matter is there are principles that needs to be adhered, i.e. those who are committing acts of terror, and no matter where they come from or how they are being supported, need to be challenged and indeed need to be removed. So the peace and tranquility will return to the region. It really is not a nuclear science to sort of say that it's only the regional governments that want to have peace and tranquility. And they know, and it's clearly the fact that peace and tranquility will be benefiting all the regional governments.
The Russian and Turkish presidents are in Tehran for a summit on Syria with their Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. The trilateral event among Putin, Raisi, and Erdogan will be held under a framework of the Astana peace process, which was set up in Kazakhstan in 2017. The talks are aimed at putting an end to the Syrian conflict through political means. Syria was among the issues discussed during Raisi's meeting with Erdogan earlier today. The two presidents also discussed a wide range of bilateral issues, including counterterrorism measures. In a joint presser after a meeting, Raisi stressed the need to combat terrorists operating under any title.
Terrorist organizations might have different names, but regardless of their titles, they put the security of people at risk, and we need to fight them. We reject double standards by the West regarding the fight against terrorism and its classification of terrorists based on their names.
The president underlined the need for bilateral cooperation between Tehran and Ankara on regional issues. He said Iran and Turkey, as two powerful states in West Asia, can contribute to not only regional security, but global security as well. Erdogan also noted that combating terrorism is of the essence. He also called for the expansion of cooperation between the two countries in the fields of energy and defense. Before the joint presser, officials of the two countries signed a number of cooperation agreements on expanding bilateral ties in different fields, including in trade and security. Now, Iran calling historic a memorandum of understanding between its national oil company and Russia's energy giant Gazprom for joint investment in the energy sector. Managing Director of the National Iranian Oil Company, Mohsen Khojasamer, and Gazprom's Deputy Chairman, Vitaly Markelov, signed the MOU virtually, and that just hours before Russian President Vladimir Putin landed in Tehran for a summit on Syria. Khojasamer said the document will be Iran's largest foreign investment on record. The Russian company will spend $40 billion to help develop Iran's Kish and North Pars gas fields, as well as six oil fields. Will also be involved in the construction of gas pipelines. When asked about the U.S. sanctions, the Iran official said that bans on Tehran and Moscow will make no difference in fulfilling the agreement. Iran has the world's second largest gas reserves after Russia. A report by the United Nations condemns Israel's persistence in its entrenched culture of impunity. A U.N. special committee tasked with investigating Israel's human rights violations also criticized the protracted occupation of Palestinian lands. The committee denounced Israel for the use of excessive force against Palestinians. It said that regime forces killed 60 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank only in the first half of this year. The committee also pointed to the increase in settler violence against the Palestinians and said that perpetrators often go unpunished. The report criticized the regime for its administrative detention of Palestinians, demolition of their homes, torture, and ill treatment of detainees. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed Israel's plan to build 2,000 new settler units in the town of Beit Safada in the occupied East Al Quds. Hamas says that Israel's continued settlement activities reveal the plots to Judaize Palestinian towns. Meantime, Israel says it has launched airstrikes against the besieged Gaza Strip in response to gunfire from the territory. Now, to discuss those developments and get an update, we're now joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon. Ashraf, over to you.
Well, Maruz, as about 2 hours ago, Israeli drones attacked a Hamas security post in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun, completely destroying it. The security post is part of the Hamas's border patrol forces patrolling the area in the north of the enclave. The Israeli regime has claimed that the drone attack was a retaliation for alleged firing of a bullet by a sniper from Gaza earlier today, although no one has claimed responsibility for such firing any weapons towards the Israeli regime. Israeli attacks take place almost on a daily basis against Palestinians throughout Palestine, and especially in the in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli military also announced that it was installing the so-called Iron Dome missile interception system units inside the occupied territories in an area called Kiryat Gat, not far from the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the Israeli decision to build 2,000 new settlement units in occupied Al-Quds in the near the town of Beit Safafa. Hamas said that such a move by the Israeli regime was emboldened by the visit of U.S. President Joe Biden, and Hamas said that such building of settlements only aims to further Judaize Al-Quds and the surrounding area, and also is part of the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Al-Quds. Hamas has also warned the Israeli regime against such moves in occupied Al-Quds, Beirut.
Okay, thanks for that, Ashraf Shannon in Gaza. Now, moving on, Russia says its forces have destroyed a Western-supplied arms depot in an industrial zone near the Ukrainian city of Odessa.
The armed forces of the Russian Federation continue their special military operation in Ukraine. In Odessa region, high-precision weapons destroyed storage facilities with ammunition for weapons supplied by the U.S. and European countries.
The Russian Defense Ministry spokesman did not specify the type of weapons being stored there. Meantime, the Russian military keeps bombing and shelling Ukrainian cities as the war grinds through its fifth month. Ukrainian officials say at least four people were injured and dozens of houses destroyed during an intense shelling of Odessa. Kiev also claims its forces have pushed back Russians and killed some 40 of them north of Donetsk region after several days of fighting. Russia has taken full control of Luhansk and half of Donetsk that together form Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. Moscow says it has prioritized to destroy Ukraine's long-range missiles and artillery, and that after the Ukrainian military recently hit Russian supply lines using Western-supplied missiles. Meantime, the European Union approves another 500 million euros to supply arms to Ukraine, and that takes the bloc's total financial support for Kiev to 2.5 billion euros. There is growing disquiet in the bloc regarding the impact of sanctions against Russia that are having on the EU's economy. Jerome Hughes reports.
EU foreign affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem. And then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialize.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
Un peu le prix à payer.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, China warning it will take forceful measures if U.S. House of Speaker Nancy Pelosi pays a visit to Taiwan.
If the U.S. side is bent on having its own way, China will take resolute and forceful measures to firmly defend national sovereignty and territorial integrity. All consequences resulting from this must be entirely the responsibility of the United States side.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says his country is firmly opposed to any form of official exchanges between Washington and Taipei. He stressed such a visit seriously violates the One China principle and sends a wrong signal to separatist forces in Taiwan. The Taiwanese Foreign Ministry says it has not received relevant information about any visit by Pelosi, who will reportedly lead a delegation to Indonesia, Japan, Malaysia, and Singapore. Beijing is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taiwan, a several island that China considers part of its own territory. Recently, President Joe Biden also angered China after a promise to defend Taiwan militarily if attacked. An amber warning for extreme heat issued in the UK, a country with a policy to rapidly reduce climate damage and greenhouse gas emissions. But as Said Kuruza reports, a combination of cost of living crisis and the need to find a new prime minister is calling into question Britain's commitment to reaching net zero by 2050.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, oh, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg Climate Dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Saeed Purizup, London.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی
In the path of the Imam
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini protested to the ratification of the scandalous bill known as capitulation in the Iranian parliament in 1963. The ratification of this bill would grant American nationals absolute immunity before law. In other words, if a U.S. national committed a crime in Iran, the Iranian judiciary could not prosecute and punish him, and he should be transferred to his country to be dealt with. After the bill was passed into a law at the Iranian parliament, Imam Khomeini castigated the regime of Shah and was soon arrested and sent to exile to Turkey. Today, we are going to touch upon the events after. Stay tuned, please. After sending Imam Khomeini to exile to Turkey, his family didn't hear from him for 5 months. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, says, When the Imam was arrested, we didn't have any information of him for 5 months. At last, I lost my patience and told Mr. Ishraqi, How long should we be uninformed? Perhaps they have killed the Imam and Mustafa. Shouldn't we be informed? You and Mr. Pasandide should do something. They have taken two people from my family, my husband and my son. My distress was reported to the Savak And after a few days, there was a message to assure us that these two people are alive and to make sure we could choose a person to meet them. We intended to send the Imam's brother, Mr. Pasandide, but it was not accepted, and thus we agreed to send the son-in-law of Ayatollah Khansari and another man whom had been chosen by the regime. Nearly 6 months after Imam Khomeini's arrest and exile, his first letter was received whereby he had informed the family of his health. In part of the letter, he had written, "Thank God I am fine. Don't be worried at all. Whatever Almighty God has ordained is good and will happen. Yet it may be that you dislike something while it is good for you. Thank God Mustafa is fine and there is no worry. I am just a little worried as I don't hear from you. I entrust you to God Almighty. If you write a letter, let all children write a few words themselves." Lady Sarafi continues, "Each one of us wrote a letter in a few lines. It was just greetings and sent it with a can of Sohan candy to Turkey. But the agents of regime didn't let it reach Bursa, the place of Imam's exile, because they didn't want to disclose his residence for Iranians, especially the students abroad. The Imam and Mustafa were taken to Istanbul, and they met with them in Istanbul. They met with each other and gave the answer to the letters were given very briefly. Yet these letters were like the spirit breathed into our body." Imam Khomeini's wife relates, "When Mustafa entered Bursa, he found his father in a room with curtains drawn. He immediately draws the curtains away. In front of the room, there was a roughly large and pleasant yard. His father laughs at him, saying, 'I have been in this room for 2 months, but I didn't draw the curtains away as I didn't want them to think that I am tired of this condition. You drew them away as soon as you came.' Then they both laughed." Imam Khomeini added, "I haven't looked through the curtains even once, although I was alone in the room." During his exile in Turkey, Imam Khomeini was taken to Izmir to visit the cemetery of many Sunni scholars who had been killed because of opposing the programs of Ataturk. This visit had been planned by Savak to intimidate Imam Khomeini. Lady Sarafi continues, "In Turkey, once the Imam and Mustafa were taken to Izmir, the Imam used to repeat this sentence that, 'The day when we reached Izmir, somewhere we saw many tombs as mass graves. I asked, "What is this?" The Turkish security head answered, "When Ataturk revolted against religion, the ulema rose up against him and Ataturk killed all of them, and some of them were buried here." Imam Khomeini said, "I told myself the Turkish Sunni scholars rose up against Ataturk and all were killed, but no scholar has been killed during the recent events in Iran. No one had been killed till then." The Imam related this story bitterly several times. Imam Khomeini was in exile in Turkey nearly for 1 year. Then he was sent to Najaf in Iraq. The Pahlavi regime wanted to eclipse the imam's greatness and influence before great ulemas such as Grand Ayatollahs Hakim, Khoi, Shahrudi, and Shirazi. Ms. Saghafi recounts the story. The imam said, once the Turkish security agents came along with the head of security of Bursa, saying, would you like to go to Najaf? On one hand, it would be good, but on the other hand, it was not good to accept my exile personally, even if it was to Najaf. I asked them to give me time to think on it. But they came the day after and said that I had to go to Najaf. I said, whatever happens is good. So they brought us from Bursa to Istanbul and then to Baghdad. Imam Khomeini was taken to Iraq secretly and under tough security measures. But after entering Baghdad, the Imam and his son, Haj Agha Mustafa, went to Kazemain to visit the shrine of Imam Musa Kazem and Imam Muhammad Taqi, peace upon them. At the shrine of Imam Musa Kazem, some of the Iranians recognized the Imam, and the news were quickly spread among the people, and very soon, many seminary students came to board the Imam. Imam Khomeini stayed in the cities of Samarra and Karbala for a few days, and then came to Najaf. But his family was unaware of his transfer from Turkey to Iraq. 10 days later, they received a letter from him and were no more concerned. Ms. Saghafi says, we would hear for 1 week that the Imam had been taken to Najaf, but we were not certain. We asked the Savak, but they would not answer to disturb us. They would not send the telegram either. And it would take at least 15 days for a letter to reach the destitution. Finally, after 10 days of rumors on the issue, I received a letter from him to know that he was in Najaf.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Of course, Ghadir, the main purpose of Ghadir was the vilayat of Ali ibn Abi Talib. And the first famous words that he uttered at that time where he says, Man kuntu mawlahu fa'adhu aliyun mawla. Now, as I said it many times, you know, no learned Sunni scholar will ever deny the event or these words that the Prophet uttered in Ghadir. But then they say, well, you know, we differ with one another on the issue of the meaning of the word mawla. And sometimes the question is put forward. They say, why didn't the Prophet use a very clear term? Why didn't he say, you know, Khalifa? Well, if you look at the versions that we have, it has been explained in all different ways. Even the poet from Medina by the name of Hassan bin Thabit al-Ansari, who was there, and he was a poet, so he's not only an Arab. He is an Arab who knows the language. He is an Arab who is able to compose poetry, actually about many different events which took place in the life of the Prophet. And even on the day of Ghadir, he came to the Prophet and he said, do you allow me to recite some lines of poetry? about this event. And there he says very clearly that, you know, a time came where the Prophet asked the people that Allah is your Mawla and I am your Mawla. Do you accept it? And when they said yes, then he says that, فَقَالَ لَهُمْ يَا عَلِي فَقَالَ لَهُ يَا عَلِي. Then the Prophet said to Ali, stand up. فَعِنِّي جَعَلْتُكَ بَعْدِي إِمَامًا وَهَادِيًا. These are his words in poetry. That, O Ali, I have appointed you as a Hadi and an Imam. So Hassan bin Sabit, an Arab, a poet, took these words as Mawla in the meaning of Hadi and Imam. What else do you want? You're sitting there 1400 years back and saying, well, you know, let us look at the dictionary. There are seven meanings of Mawla. And then you try to find the one which will suit your aqidah. No, look at what the people understood at that time. When Umar comes and congratulates and says, Asbahta Mawlai wa Mawla al-Mu'mineen wa Mu'mina. Kull Mu'minin wa Mu'mina. You have become a Mawla. Becoming a Mawla in what sense there? Not friend. And so, anyway, that's another discussion. I just digress from my, you know, notes here. I wanted to share with you, you know, when people say, well, why didn't the Prophet use the term Khalifa? If that is the issue, if we present to you a hadith where the Prophet uses the word Khalifa for Ali, would you accept it then? Or is it just, you know, argument after arguments? There is a very famous Sunni scholar of hadith who was actually contemporary of Muhammad bin Ismail al-Bukhari, the compiler of Sahih Bukhari. They lived at the same time. You know, Bukhari died in 256 after Hijrah, and this other alim by the name of Ibn Abi Asim died in 286. They lived almost at the same time, but Asim was there longer than Bukhari. And he has a book, Kitab al-Sunnah. In that book, he has a narration where he quotes his chain of narration going all the way to Abdullah ibn Abbas, a very prominent companion. And there he says, قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم that the Prophet of Islam said to Ali, أنت مني بمنزلة هارون من موسى إلا أنك لست نبيا. The Prophet is saying to Ali, you are to me at the same station and level or status as Harun was to Musa, except that you are not a prophet. إِنَّهُ لَا يَنْبَغِي أَنْ عَضْحَبُ إِلَّا وَأَنْتَ خَلِيفَتِي فِي كُلِّ مُؤْمِنٍ مِّنْ بَعْدِي. He says, it is necessary that I go. Means I'm going to die one day. It is necessary that I go while you will be my successor. وَأَنْتَ خَلِيفَتِي. You will be my Khalifa fi kulli mu'min min ba'di, for every believer after me. You're looking for clear words? Any more clear words than those? No. These days, you know, some of our young people have newly learned ilm hadith, and they say, well, you know, all these hadiths, maulanas and scholars and speakers narrate, these are all fabrications and from ghulat. So easy to say dha'if and use the term ghali. Well, this is not from the Shia sources anyway. This is from Sunni source. And if you want to know the authenticity of this hadith, a very prominent Salafi scholar, Wahhabi scholar of our century, a scholar of hadith by the name of Sheikh Muhammad Nasiruddin al-Albani. He died in 1999. Originally from Albanian background, but raised in Syria.
And he became a very prominent scholar in the science of hadith among the Wahhabis, the Salafis. And he actually published this book of Kitab al-Sunnah of Ibn Abi Asim with annotations by himself as a scholar of hadith. About every hadith he will say, this is right or wrong, za'if or sahih, you know. And so in that and annotations that he has on this Kitab al-Sunnah of Ibn Abi Asim, Sheikh Albani makes the comment. He says, إسناده حسن ورجاله ثقات رجال الشيخين. It says the chain of narration is good of this hadith, and its narrators are trustworthy among the narrators of the two sheikh, Bukhari and Muslim. So you have a hadith from the Sunni sources, verified by most prominent Salafi scholar of hadith in this century, where the Prophet says that Ali is my Khalifa for every mu'min min ba'di, after me. You know, they very, very cleverly say, well, yes, we believe he's a Khalifa, but he's a fourth one. That would be the response. When you say, well, the Prophet said, you know, Ali will be my Khalifa after me. Well, Rasulullah didn't say Ali would be Khalifa after the three Khulafa. Min ba'di, after me. What does that mean? He didn't say after 25 years, after I die. When he says min ba'di, this is after me, immediately after me. And that is why we say, you know, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadun Rasulullah, Ali waliullah wa khalifatuhu bila fasl.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Ali. حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
In the limelight.
Israeli regime forces keep killing Americans while U.S. officials give them a pass, says Alice Sperry, author, in an article published under the heading No Path to Justice. Here's the story. Early two decades before Israeli regime forces killed Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aqileh, shooting a single bullet into her head while she was reporting from the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, an Israeli troop drove a bulldozer over American peace activist Rachel Corrie, crushing her to death. Both killings left little real doubt about the dynamics at play. Abu Aqileh was standing with a group of colleagues, wearing a vest clearly marked press, nowhere near the fighting that had taken place earlier that morning. Corrie was nonviolently protesting the demolition of a Palestinian family's home in Gaza. She was wearing a fluorescent orange jacket with reflective strips and had been on the scene for several hours, at times speaking into a megaphone. In the moment before her death, Corrie was standing in the path of the bulldozer, as other activists had been doing throughout the day. As the driver pushed the machine forward, she climbed onto a mound of dirt so she would be clearly visible, according to witness testimony reviewed by The Intercept. The driver kept advancing. When she fell to the ground, the dirt engulfed her, but the driver moved several feet forward before backing off, effectively crushing her twice. The possibility that he did not see her, as he later claimed, defies all credibility. Still, the Israeli regime never took responsibility for her death. And while the U.S. government rejected the results of the Israeli regime investigation, it did nothing to ensure that such a killing would not happen again. So did it. Corrie was killed on March 16, 2003, when she was 23. 12 years later, on the anniversary of her death, her parents and sister met with Antony Blinken for the last time. The Deputy Secretary of State spoke to them in sincere way they had come to know well. "Come back any time," he told them as the meeting came to a close. Corries didn't want to come back. They had been meeting with Blinken for years, and they were tired. When he asked earnestly, "What can I do for you?" they felt frustrated. "I appreciate your kindness," Craig Corrie told Blinken, adding, "I'm glad you are personally engaged, but unless you engage your institution, it doesn't do me any good." He's asking, "What can I do for you?" Cindy Corrie, Rachel's mother, told Intercept, adding, "But there is a point at which it's like, what are you guys going to do? I can't tell you what tools you have to use," echoed Sarah, Rachel's sister, adding, "You need to be telling us." Rachel's killing had brought the Corries to hundreds of offices like Blinken's over the years, but nowhere closer to the accountability they were seeking. Blinken today, the Secretary of State, was one of several senior U.S. officials who worked closely with the family during their years-long crusade for justice, and one of a number who now occupy top positions in the Biden administration. The Corries liked him, and they appreciated his efforts and warmth. In emails, he signed himself Tony. He always responded to their letters and regularly met with them for longer than scheduled. Ultimately, however, Blinken failed them. As they prepared to leave his office for the last time, Sarah told him, "There was a promise made to the President of the United States from Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. Your government said that there never happened, but that promise was never fulfilled, she recalled, adding, "You've still got a problem here." Blinken nodded, "I know." Walking away, Sarah knew she was done. Blinken had asked her to follow up with an email. She wondered why she should be the one to do that, why one of the staffers in the room couldn't take notes. "I felt like we could go on like this for the rest of our lives," she said, adding, "I think in some way I needed them to say no. If they weren't going to do anything, that's what I needed to hear out of that meeting." Sarah was 29 when her sister was killed, and since then, she had devoted herself completely to lobbying the U.S. government for action. You think about what your life is in your 30s, developing your career, raising your family, she said in an interview last month, adding, "Mine was this process." She had been diagnosed with Crohn's disease before Rachel was killed, but the stress of the last 12 years had taken a toll on Sarah's health. The day of that meeting with Blinken, she felt too sick to get out of bed, but powered through it. She had two more meetings at the Senate that day. In the hallway outside Blinken's office, she remembered the words of another senior official, Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff at the State Department at the time of Rachel's death. "You are doing the right thing," Wilkerson had warned the family, adding, "but you may never see results. So don't lose your health." Those words haunted Sarah now. "I'm not going to lose my health over banging my head against the wall," she finally decided, adding, "I knew at that point I couldn't keep doing this. I had reached my limit." That was in 2015. Since then, Cindy and Craig Corey have continued to honor Rachel's memory through the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. They launched a sister city partnership between Olympia, Washington, where she grew up, and Rafah, the city on the Egypt-Gaza border where she was killed by the Zionist regime forces. They speak in support of Palestinians at events around the world. Sarah was not much an activist herself, but she had seen it as her civic duty to ensure that her government worked as it was supposed to. The endeavor of lobbying U.S. officials to do something about Rachel's killing had become all-consuming, barely leaving time to grieve. After the last meeting with Blinken, she stored the piles of documents she had accumulated over the years and tried to focus on her life. She took up classes and flight lessons. When the Coreys gave up, the U.S. government's effort to get accountability for Rachel also came to an end. Craig Corey said, "When we stopped, they stopped. That wagon was in a bunch of mud. If you weren't pushing on it, you didn't go anywhere." Then in May, Abu Aghla was killed. Several independent investigations, including one by the United Nations, concluded that she was shot by an Israeli regime force, describing the shooting as targeted and the bullet that killed her as well-aimed. Her death was referred to the International Criminal Court. But following a tested playbook in such situations, the Zionist regime refused to take responsibility. Thank you.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on December 17, 2008 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Qadir. The emphasis that our magnanimous Imam Khomeini and many other prominent religious scholars have placed on the unity between religion and politics is in fact rooted in Islamic teachings, especially the great lesson that Ghadir taught us. This shows the importance of the issue. All the people who interpret Ghadir in this way, that is, all Shi'as and even many non-Shi'a Muslims who have a similar interpretation, many constantly pay attention to the fact that the issue of government is a critical issue, and that it is a high priority in Islam. No one should be indifferent to the issue of government. The important role of governments in guiding or misleading nations is a historical reality. The fact that the Islamic Republic places so much emphasis on the appropriate management of the country in the Constitution and elsewhere is all due to the strong emphasis that Islam has placed on this issue. This is a point that must not be ignored.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The fact that the Holy Prophet of Islam introduced Ali ibn Abi Talib as his successor in Ghadir al-Khum is another point that is closely related to the first point. What were the defining characteristics of Imam Ali's life both before and after this event? These characteristics can provide us with a yardstick. Moving on the path of righteousness and attaching great importance to Allah's satisfaction were the primary features of Imam Ali's life. no matter how much hardship and selflessness were required to continue this life, that was the most important feature of Imam Ali's life. From his childhood to the moment he was martyred, the commander of the faithful alayhi salam remained rock solid for the sake of Allah. He made wholehearted efforts and was never frustrated with his efforts for Allah. He tried to promote Islam when it was time to do so. He fought for Islam when it was time to fight. He was patient when patience was required. He assumed the leadership of his society when it was necessary for him to do so.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com.